Hi, thanks for spending your lunch hour with us on The Record. It's Thursday. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. 174. That's how many craft beer makers we have in the Seattle-Tacoma area. And later this hour, we'll unpack this region's long-standing love story with beer. But first, as you just heard in our newscast, we've got another candidate for Seattle mayor, former Western Washington U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkan. That now puts the number of candidates at 13 in the wake of Mayor Ed Murray's announcement that he will not run for re-election. But KUOW reporter David Hyde explains, among the current candidates for mayor, Jenny Durkan has one of the more impressive resumes.
She was nominated by Barack Obama back in 2009, and at that time reportedly the first openly gay U.S. attorney. And in that job, she's credited with being a leader on issues like the fight against cybercrime. But here in Seattle, she's best known for pushing the police department toward reform. She actually sued the city of Seattle over this and helped negotiate what's called the consent decree back in 2012. And that's, of course, that settlement agreement between the city and the Department of Justice about police misconduct, and especially about the use of force or the misuse of force.
Okay, so that's part of what she accomplished as U.S. attorney, but as a possible mayor of Seattle, what are people saying about her?
You know, that she's less of a maverick, maybe, as some of these other candidates, and more of a bring people to the table and negotiate type of mayor. Of course, we don't know yet because she's just running, but Durkan's known as being a progressive Democrat. She's got friends in high places like former Governor Chris Gregoire. And the consultants I spoke with said she would be considered liberal to very liberal if we were comparing her to other Democrats in the National Party, but maybe less so for Seattle. Which is kind of a little bit more like Berkeley than it used to be. So Jenny Durkan probably is going to appeal to portions of Seattle's labor and business establishment.
How does her candidacy affect the Seattle mayor's race? There are already a dozen candidates in the running.
So this is a big thing. Conventional wisdom is that she is going to be a front runner, if not the front runner. Kathy Allen, who is a political consultant in town, said she thinks Durkan might be able to tap into the anger and sort of the political energy that's still out there after the national election that we saw in the Women's March in January. But of course, she joins a really large field of candidates, as you say, heading into the primary this summer. And that includes former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, activist Nikita Oliver, urban planner Carrie Moon, State Senator Bob Hasegawa, and another name that's being floated today that I'm hearing is Seattle City Council member Lorena Gonzalez. She hasn't declared, but she might, and the deadline to file to run is still not here yet. That's on Friday, May 19th.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens in the next week here. KUOW's David Hyde with the politics team. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeannie.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. A cluster of fatal birth defects has left several families in eastern Washington mourning the loss of children they will never know. The families are frustrated by the years of questions about what happened to their babies, questions that still remain unanswered. EarthFix reporter Courtney Flatt looked into what's happening in Washington's Yakima River Basin.
Two toddlers run around Sally Garcia Acosta's house. They squeal as they take their toy cars for a spin, through the den and around the kitchen corner. She sits on the couch beside a small butterfly-adorned box. It holds some of Garcia Acosta's most sacred belongings, memories of her deceased daughter, Maria Rosario Perez. Garcia Acosta lifts a polka dot dress from the box. It was way too big for Maria's tiny frame. She weighed 3 pounds, 6.6 ounces when she was prematurely born.
It was the smallest one we could find on such short notice.
Maria was born with a rare and fatal birth defect called anencephaly. It's striking at an alarming rate, about 4 times the national average, in 3 eastern Washington counties. The condition leaves babies who survived a term without their skulls and brains completely formed.
It's hard for you, you know, you have this hope that you're going to have the baby, you're going to get to enjoy him, you get to see him grow up, and then out of nowhere, it just gets taken away from you. And there's nothing that nobody can explain to tell you why.
Nurse Sarah Barron was the first to raise the alarm. In 2010, she worked at Prosser Memorial Hospital, where she says they delivered maybe 300 babies per year. In a 2-month period, she says 2 babies were born with anencephaly.
And I'm thinking right then, this is bad. I've been a nurse for over 30 years. I saw one case 30 years ago when I was in nursing school, one case 12 years ago at another hospital, and now I've seen 2 in 2 months at this little tiny hospital.
Other healthcare workers in the area had also seen an increase in anencephaly cases. So Barron alerted the Washington State Department of Health. Its epidemiologists found elevated rates of anencephaly cases in the Yakima River Basin. But why? State epidemiologists called in the CDC, studied literature reviews, and held listening sessions in eastern Washington to get a handle on possible causes. They eventually interviewed 17 mothers in the area. The investigators ruled out every concern that came to their attention, things like radiation from Hanford, pesticide exposure, and nitrates in drinking water. In the end, after 6 years, they found nothing. Kathy Wasserman is the state epidemiologist. She says cluster investigations are notoriously difficult.
It's really disappointing for us to not be able to say, you know, yes, this is what we learned and this is what we can do and we can prevent this heartache and this tragedy from affecting families.
But some people think there's more that could be done. Sarah Barron, the nurse who first reported these cases, wonders if there might be more connection to rural areas. She points to a map on her computer screen. She says other anencephaly clusters across the country also appear to be in less populated areas.
In our counties, it was the farm owners as well as the farm workers that were getting the anencephaly. So it was not economic, it was not race, was not necessarily by diet. So there's something else out there that's related and we don't know what it is.
Does that make your mind go a little bit more to environmental factors?
It does.
One thing that's certain about anencephaly, women of childbearing age can reduce their risk by taking folic acid. Sally Garcia Costa, who's taken folic acid during all of her pregnancies, hopes someday there'll be answers.
It is frustrating because you figured, okay, you know, if it's not my only child, you know, that's going on, that other people are, this is happening to. If nobody talks about it and everybody just pushes it aside, it's never going to get figured out.
The state's going to continue monitoring pregnancies with anencephaly through next January. I'm Courtney Flatt in Prosser, Washington.
It's KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Coming up in about 30 minutes, moms, you're aware of the rules, right?
Rules about wearing your baby and rules about sleeping with your baby and only feeding them organic food and only having wooden toys, and you can't recarpet the playroom because it'll off gas, that kind of thing.
That's Seattle writer Claire Dieterer talking with Bill Radke about parenting and pressures and midlife crises. But before that, let's talk about beer. Seattle has a long-standing love story with beer. You probably already know that, but there's evidence of that love story. We have more craft beer makers here than any other region in America. 174 of them in the Seattle-Tacoma area, according to the market researcher Datafinity. What is there about this long relationship between the Northwest and beer? I have a couple of people here who may be able to answer that question. Kendall Jones runs the Washington Beer Blog, and Robin Schumacher is owner and brewer at Stoop Brewing in Ballard. Kendall, you first. What's the history of beer here in Washington State?
Well, as far as we're talking about craft beer, or what used to be called microbrew back when it first hit the streets here in Seattle, there was a time in America when there was only, you know, you can count the number of breweries in America on your fingers, and at least two of them were in Washington. When there was only five in the country, two of them were in Washington. One of them was in Seattle. Red Hook opened in 1982. They were one of the very, very early pioneers of craft beer. And we just developed a love for craft beer long before the rest of the nation did. So it's really not surprising that we're kind of ahead of everybody else. We were one of the first places it happened, and everybody else is playing catch up and has been for a long time.
You mentioned that Washington State had two of the five regional breweries even before the sort of microbrewery thing happened. Were those Rainier and Olympia?
No. There were regional breweries like Rainier and Olympia dotted all over the country, you know, hundreds of them. But they were consolidating. In the late 70s, they were all consolidating, and there was fewer and fewer breweries, as the biggest of them were buying up all the smaller ones being like small ones like Rainier. And it got to the point where there was only 75 breweries in the country. And that was like the low point.
What's the legacy of Rainier today? Aside from the fact that it's an affordable beer to buy in bars.
It's its own. It's just one of many brands. It's owned by Pabst now, so it's nostalgic for Seattle. It's the beer that I grew up seeing in the fridge when I was a kid. My dad explained to me when I was 12 years old, son, I'm a Rainier man. You're gonna be a Rainier man too, because they're, you know, we don't, those Olympia guys. No. We're Rainier men. So that's one of my oldest. That's one of my original memories of beer was my dad drinking bottles of Rainier beer around the campfire, you know, and I think a lot of people have similar stories with Olympia and Rainier that way. And it was true. It's like in Seattle back in the day, you know, there was every bar had either an Olympia sign or a Rainier sign, and which bar you went to depended on which beer you liked. So, but I think that was the same thing all over the country. And then it slowly consolidation started to happen, and the next thing you know, every bar in the country has the same beer. They have Bud Light and Coors Light, you know, and that's kind of where we were headed. But the craft beer movement that started in the early 80s was kind of a reaction to that, or I guess kind of a natural offshoot of that, because people like choice.
Why do you think that the microbrewery or local brewery movement is so strong here in the Northwest?
Well, there's something that I like to call our Northwest sensibilities. And this is just one way of expressing that. We also are the kind of people who were early adopters of the $4 cup of coffee. We're the type of people who will go to REI and buy a $125 rain jacket that is very good instead of buying a $75 rain jacket that's adequate. A lot of that has to do with economics. There's no doubting that. But we just have always had a interest in maybe higher quality and buying local, and there's no doubt about it that craft beer is a local product at its core. I mean, you can call local anywhere in the state. You know, a brewery in Spokane is local, a brewery in Portland is local, when you're comparing it to the big beers that's coming out of Los Angeles or St. Louis. So I think this is kind of part of our sensibilities. I've never really been able to put my finger on why we're that way. It's kind of like the way that we tend to be innovative people up here too. You know, the jet airliner, you know, was invented by Boeing, and now it's everywhere. And the graphic user interface was invented by Microsoft. These things have changed the world, you know. And like I said, the $4.50 cup of coffee was invented by Starbucks. So, you know, it's just something that we do up here. We innovate, we create, and the beer thing just fits right into that.
Robin Schumacher, you are one of these innovators. So what do you think it is about the Northwest that lends itself to a strong craft beer movement?
Yeah, I would agree that the Northwest, we tend to like local products. That's definitely part of the appeal. I also, this is probably not very scientific, but I also feel like our weather and our outdoor, our love of the outdoors actually fits into that also, and it's probably just a personal preference, but I've always loved like beer in the outdoors, and I think if you ask a lot of craft beer drinkers, there is that also, and we just have beautiful mountains, beautiful lakes, so that's kind of from my heart. It's less scientific than, it's probably less realistic, but that's kind of what I believe. But also, we definitely like local products in the Northwest, for sure.
I'm talking with Robin Schumacher. She's the co-owner and brewer at Stoop Brewing in Ballard. I'm also talking with Kendall Jones. He runs the Washington Beer Blog. We're talking about why we have such a strong craft beer movement here. There was a recent study that found that the Seattle-Tacoma area has more craft breweries than any other region in the country. We have 174 of those. And Kendall, one of the reasons you think we might be such a hot spot for beer, you've said this before, is that we have a lot of agriculture. So how do you think that drives breweries?
Well, that's, you can brew a beer in Washington with all Washington grown ingredients. It's really easy to do. It's not so easy to do in other parts of the country. And I think our local brewers, you know, they appreciate that, and they're able to establish relationships with the people who provide the ingredients, primarily the hop farmers. Mm-hmm. You know, even like, I don't want to say small, but the mid-sized breweries like Robin's, you know, you have relationships with hop growers,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah, we meet the farmers and
go back east and ask a brewery back there. You know, which hop farm and on which part of the farm do you like to get your hops from?
Yeah.
And around here, there's brewers that can tell you there's this one part, this one hill on this one farm that has the best Cascade hops or has the best Citra hops. And we have an advantage that way. And I like the fact that we take advantage of it because I like hoppy beers. But I think that closeness to the ingredients really does help and has helped foster the whole movement.
Robin, you've been agreeing a lot with what Kendall has been saying, and you have a relationship with your own hops farmer, yes?
Yeah, we don't have one farmer, but we do go to Yakima or Willamette Valley, and you can meet the farmers. You meet the people who are actually growing and producing the hops. We drive over during fresh hop season during harvest and pick up hops that are just harvested that day and drive them back and brew that night. So it's a really cool community. It feels like... just everyone's working together to produce the product.
And we should point out that as the beer industry has skyrocketed over the last 20 or 30 years, so has the hop industry.
Yeah.
The hop farmers are planting more and more hops. This year is going to be the largest hop crop in U.S. history, making it one bigger than last year. And there's now brewers like Robin have access to over 150 different hops. And if you go back to the early 1970s, you know, until before 1972, there was basically one that was, you know, most of it was this one particular hop called Cluster, and that's what everybody used in their beers, whether it was Budweiser or Coors or Miller or whatever. They weren't very innovative and creative about which hops they used because it didn't matter that much for their beer. But once craft beer came around, all of a sudden, breweries like Stoop all of a sudden are just like, we need crazy hop flavors. We need more hop flavors. And then, of course, the proliferation of IPAs over the last few years has helped spur that.
Super hoppy beers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and everyone wants their beer to be set apart. And brewers are, by their nature, it's a creative science. So they're very creative people. And you give them something crazy and wacky, and they want it.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like I have a pretty clear sense of how the growing beer industry here has really boosted the hops industry here and hops growers. But I'm wondering how the economic changes here in Seattle, the fact that we have this population boom, that people are making more and more money, that it's become a more and more expensive place to live. What has that done for the local beer industry, Kendall?
That's an interesting question. A lot of the tech workers and stuff that have been moving into, so there's like the effect that it's having on the city. In the city, there's certainly a lot more money in the city. And people who can afford, these tend to be, you know, the Amazonians tend to be people that are coming to Seattle that have relatively high paying jobs. Sure, housing is expensive, but a lot of them tend to be younger and single. They tend to be a absolutely beautiful demographic for selling beer to. There's honestly, there are some ethnic issues, you know, because not everybody drinks beer, but a lot of the tech workers that are moving to town are young and they drink and they have disposable income, which makes people like Robin really happy. and people who can open bars and charge $6.50 for a pint of beer and nobody bats an eyelash.
Kendall just said that you, Robin, as a brewer and a business owner, you're really happy about this increasing affluence here in Seattle. Is that true? How have you seen this economic boom impact your business at Stoop?
Yeah, it's funny because I've lived in Seattle now about 20 years, and I kind of curse the traffic and the boom in the city. I try not to be one of those people, but, you know, when you're trying to get around town and it's really crowded and your favorite places are being torn down, and then I realize that's also... these new people coming in are the people that are, a lot of them are drinking our beer. So from a business perspective, it's really beneficial. But I would also piggyback on what Kendall said. One thing that I'm always concerned about in the craft beer industry and in a lot of industries in kind of lily white Seattle is that we do have a diversity problem. I think as craft brewers, we need to reach out to different communities, be that women, be that different ethnicities, just increase diversity in our workforce and in the people who are actually drinking the beer.
You've both raised the issue of how white the craft brewing scene here is in Seattle, both the people who are drinking it and the people who are making it. So what does that mean for the future of craft brewing, Robin?
I don't think anyone has been excluded on purpose, but there's clearly a reason why we are appealing to a certain demographic. So I think people have to take a good hard look at that and figure out why that is and make changes.
What about you, Kendall? How do you see this kind of the whiteness of the craft brewing industry here? What does that mean for the future of that?
First of all, we should point out that this is an issue that's being discussed at bigger tables than this one right now. The Brewers Association, which represents all of the craft brewers in America, they recognize this and they're addressing it. They're trying to figure out what to do. And at some point, you can't really force it. There are ethnic, economic, religious components to this. There are certain ethnicities that don't drink much alcohol, period. And, you know, there are certain religions that don't drink alcohol, period. And we can't try and force them to become beer drinkers. And then once again, we go back to those economic components. And so there's this whole big thing. We can't force it. It's just about keeping the door open and let people find it, you know. Keep making good beer and people will find it.
Kendall Jones runs the Washington Beer Blog, and Robin Schumacher is co-owner and brewer at Stoop Brewery in Ballard. It's Seattle Beer Week, and we're sharing a link with you right now on Twitter. How's Your Day tells a story you don't know from a day we all remember. On May 18th, 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted. It was one of the worst natural disasters in the history of the United States. On the same day, on the other side of the world, a South Korean teenager joined a national protest that turned deadly. It would come to be known as the Gwangju Uprising.
Yu Jae-chul. Okay, like this.
My name is Yu Jae-chul. And I'm a maintenance man. In 1980, I was 17. I lived in Gwangju City in South Korea. I was a high school student. I lived with my older sister. The night before, it was my friend's birthday party. We were drinking colas and dancing at a small discotheque. 4 or 5 of my friends and I left around midnight. We saw soldiers but didn't think much of it, and protests have been going on daily since the beginning of May.
There is a new government tonight in South Korea. Park Chung-hee, who ruled the country for more than 18 years, is dead.
During that time, there was a person named Chun Doo-hwan. He led a military coup.
Military takeover of the Seoul government and the imposition of martial law throughout the country.
And that is how the protest started. Millions and millions of people were protesting in every city all over the country. So to stop the protest, Chun Doo-hwan picked a target city, and that city was Gwangju. There are soldiers posted all throughout the city. There was a place called City Central, and it was about a mile walk. I decided to join the protest.
Thousands of anti-government protesters are in complete control of Gwangju City, moving through the streets of the provincial capital in commandeered army vehicles, many carrying weapons from an overrun government armory.
I was at the front line of the march.
Here's a lot of soldiers. We can't go here. There's a city hall. We're sitting here, and I'm not front here. Some front person, and then looks like I'm sitting like this, and then...
The leaders of the protests were facing us, telling us what to chant, walking backwards. They were flanked by these banks. One is 2 or 3 stories, and one is 8 or 10 stories high. And I didn't know, but the military had snipers on top of the banks. And then the soldiers started shooting.
It was a day in which ash
Ash extends from Mount St. Helens eastward across the Idaho Panhandle into Montana. In Yakima, Washington this morning, 85 miles north of Mount St. Helens, it was like midnight.
But residents there say it looked more like midnight. Visibility is at zero, and there are numerous reports of traffic accidents throughout the state. Police are advising people to stay inside and avoid driving.
That was an excerpt from our new podcast, How's Your Day? To hear the rest of this story about the Gwangju Uprising and all the episodes in our series, go to kuow.org/podcast. It's The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. And soon, gun dealers in Washington will be required to report when someone tries to buy a gun and fails a background check. Governor Jay Inslee signed that requirement into law yesterday as part of a crackdown on prohibited gun buyers. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has the latest in his ongoing coverage of this issue.
Survivors of domestic violence and their supporters surrounded Governor Jay Inslee at the bill signing.
Okay, this is House Bill 1501.
House Bill 1501 requires gun dealers to notify the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs within 5 days of a failed gun purchase. That information will then get transmitted to police officers in the field and victims who sign up for alerts.
It's very important to protect victims of domestic violence.
The new law will also allow police agencies to apply for grants to investigate failed gun buyers with an eye toward prosecuting them. It is a violation of state and federal law to lie on the background check form, but our months-long investigation with King 5 News revealed that police in Washington rarely, if ever, follow up on denied gun purchases. The new law aims to change that.
You can clap if you want.
It's a good bill.
After the bill signing,
Courtney, oh my gosh.
Domestic violence survivors Paula Harwood and Courtney Weaver embraced.
We did it.
Yay.
We all did it.
Late last year, Harwood learned from a reporter that the man she has a permanent protection order against tried to buy a gun.
To me, that's a matter of life and death.
In 2010, Courtney Weaver was shot in the face by her then boyfriend in California. She lives in fear of the day he gets out of prison in 2019 and says she wants to know if he ever tries to buy a gun.
It would be the surest sign, you know, be the surest way to predict what he was going to do next.
Would-be gun buyers fail a background check in Washington state about 4,000 times a year. In 2015, more than half of those denied buyers had been convicted of a crime or had a restraining order against them. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Thanks for joining us on KUOW, and hopefully you already know this, but this Sunday is Mother's Day. And whatever kind of relationship you have with your mother, there's no getting around the powerful role that mothers play in who we are, even as adults. KUOW's poetry correspondent Elizabeth Austin is here with a poem related to mothers, power, and what we sometimes call mother nature. Elizabeth talked with Bill Radke.
A different perspective on nature and us. I like that. What is this poem that gives us that?
It's called Pastoral Power, and it was written by Jane Wong. She recently finished her PhD at UW. So her first full-length collection of poems, Overpour, is dedicated to her mother, who immigrated to the U.S. as a young woman from a small agricultural village in southern China. And like other poems in this book, Pastoral Power is thinking about how that place of origin influenced Jane's mother and, by extension, Jane. So Mother Nature in the sense of the natural world, but also in terms of the nature of the mother, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And how is all that working in this poem?
So this poem has its roots in a trip that Jane took with her family back to the village where her mother grew up. It was the first time Jane's mother, Jinai, had gone home since emigrating. and it was Jane's first visit to China. But having said all that, don't expect a narrative.
Right.
This poem is made up of constantly shifting images, and it's the instability of those images that's a big part of how this poem works on us as listeners. So here's Jane Wong reading an excerpt of Pastoral Power.
Sometimes I think, can Walden exist in China? Returning to nature is a luxury we keep, like this floral soap I can't bear to clean my filthy face with. To leave the village, to return to the village in a better dress. My cousin pissed out of a moving van, and there was sun suffocating so. Sun glimmering in the fish I eat down to the bones, my life full of debt, indebted, in death, do us. My mother said the groundhogs ate all the eggplants, and so she hit them with a shovel one by one. Little murderers, peace unto you. Fat spider of dread, spun up in half-eaten crops, a good year, a bad year, another year. To wash silk, you must wash it by hand or pay someone to wash it for you. Red washes out of an apple and the spell is broken. In Jersey, the neighborhood kid shows me a hole. I'm digging my way to China, he says. In winter, rabbits nestle in that hole and freeze, ears first. I want everything to spring up from the ground, grace, forgiveness. I want the sun to stop following me, to file a restraining order against the spiny beast. Climb up on these shoulders of miniatures to see the fallowing wilderness, replicas of replicas and the science fair kind. If I say the volcano will erupt now, you better believe it. You better bail out the sea, kill those geese in the parking lot, and eat them for dinner, dressed in rosemary and tar. Five-star meal, five stars in the night, shining how I mistook a fountain in Vegas for my mother. How I mistook Shenzhen for a forest of sneakers, this economy in growth. I smiled from ear to ear, glued in moss, the cheapest form of saccharin. To those who owe and those who own us, I might die paying off my loans if they don't begin accepting dandelions. Defeat, pumice trying to sink, 130 million migrants going home for the new year. February, brace your face for insults. My brother kicked a raccoon out of the garage and cried for days. Was it ever a question of sympathy? In July, clusters of sun gather in secret societies. The banks began charging for sleep. A tourist spits into a hot spring on a breezy day. A crane lifts a child out of a well and there is no television crew. Clearly, discomfort makes trees grow taller. With fertilizer, we can all shake from the stems, my legs dangling over the overpass. Today, Route 18 is all horns and heart. Under a microscope, bacteria blooms readily, tiny mansions of the self. Who am I to multiply? My grandfather gathers chickens by the feet, wings flapping. If you squint hard, he looks like a butterfly. In the future, I heard the continents will connect. When we turn to face each other, it's a choice.
I love this poem, Elizabeth. I loved reading it. I read it over. And when I got to the end, I read it over and over again. When I heard it, I had the poem next to me. I recommend breaking out the text and just enjoying all the images in here. Again, that was Jane Wong reading an excerpt of her poem, Pastoral Power, from her collection, Over Poor. And yes, like you said, Elizabeth, the images are they're thick and fast coming at you. And a lot of them have to do with beating back nature, right? The groundhogs are eating the eggplants. The raccoon is in the garage. The geese are in the parking lot.
Yes, exactly. And right at the center of the poem, there's that image of the mother, as you say, defending the eggplant crop from the groundhogs. And when I invited Jane into the studio to record that poem, I asked her about those conflicted images of nature, and especially that final image of the grandfather and the chickens. And here's what she had to say about it.
There is like this desire for these animals to get out of your home of sorts. So the raccoons, the geese in a way in the parking lot, the groundhogs. And yet in many ways, like, you know, we live with them too. They are part of the natural landscape as much as we inhabit it too. So that when my grandfather is holding those kind of chickens by the feet, he turns into a butterfly. I think you're right. It becomes this kind of transformation of, you know, one and the same, you know, that you are that animal in many ways. These animals who are often reviled and just kind of killed and oftentimes like, oh, gross, like a raccoon. But in fact, that they are, in many ways, the true kind of example of resilience in nature.
I think a lot of us can relate to this if we sit doing work all day and Mount Rainier is a photo on our computer wallpaper, you know, nature out there and nature inside. Elizabeth, you said at the start that this poem had to do with the influence of place. What do you mean?
Yeah, that image right at the beginning of this excerpt of the poem, to leave the village, to return to the village in a better dress. It evokes all kinds of associations of moving up and out, of class struggle, of wanting to be seen having succeeded, which in this case means leaving the rural village in China. And then contrast that with how the daughter keeps bringing up her own indebtedness, including that fantastic line, "I might die paying off my loans if they don't begin accepting dandelions." Uh-huh. So this book as a whole, it just evokes so many facets of negotiating identity with your place in a family and with your place of origin, even if you physically left it. So again, the book is called Overpour, and I recommend it.
And you can find out more about the poet, Jane Wong, and you can find the entire poem as well, Pastoral Power, all at our website, kuow.org. Elizabeth, thank you.
You're welcome, Bill.
And Bill and Elizabeth were just talking about motherhood in that poem, In Time for Mother's Day, which is a holiday our next guest will not really be celebrating. Author Claire Dieterer thinks Mother's Day feels kind of obligatory, and motherhood is already obligatory enough. She wrote a bestseller about raising a child in North Seattle and all of the rules and anxieties that came with that.
Rules about wearing your baby and rules about sleeping with your baby and only feeding them organic food and only having wooden toys and you can't recarpet the playroom because it'll off-gas, that kind of thing.
Claire Dieterer says all those rules and obligations come with a cost. In her new book, Love and Trouble, she writes about her midlife despair.
I do think there's a way in which my intense commitment to a certain quality and kind of motherhood and a certain ideal of marriage and a certain level of ambition as a worker, all these things, that's a lot of stuff to kind of keep in the air. I do think that that maybe led me to this place where I was more fragile after I turned about 44. So I just felt tired. And I talk in the book, in my new book, Love and Trouble, I talk about maybe a woman's version of midlife crisis is stopping doing stuff. You know, I was so intensely involved in every aspect of motherhood and homemaking and working. It was just sort of like, I just can't do anymore. And I just wanted to sort of take to my bed, which is ridiculous, but that's what happened. And I feel like now that I'm writing about it and talking about it with other women, there is also this quality of like, huh, it's kind of interesting. Other people feel this way too. Like, do you see this dynamic at all in your own marriage?
Yeah, without, you know, my wife didn't choose to be a radio host or a revealing author, so I'm a little cautious, yeah. But she's works and she's ambitious and tired. Yeah.
So how does that feel to you?
Well, when you talk about taking to your bed and doing less, mm-hmm. like, I think I'm guessing I speak for some husbands when I say, we're more okay with that. We do less. We know doing less, right?
Yes.
And I want to say, go ahead, honey. Do less.
I would definitely say you're speaking for one husband, which would be my husband.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, I think he's just like, you know, it's an issue of standards. Your standards are too high. Why are you trying to do things this one certain way? Why won't you let me do it my way? You know, which may not be quite such a pristine way. And somebody, I can't remember who, recently did an article about like if we'd all just let our houses be messier, we'd have better marriages.
Yeah.
And I think that the kind of marriage that I have is one where we entered together as partners into this marriage. You know, we got married in 1997 and we saw ourselves as, we were both writers at the time and we were going to build a life as writers and parents and workers and be partners in that. But then there are like pressures that are true economic pressures where my husband can earn more. And where I was, for instance, nursing, so I need to be with the babies more. And so there's these external pressures that start to bear on you. And what you had thought was going to be a series of choices and expression of partnership becomes almost like walking down this predetermined trail. And you're like, how did I end up on the same trail I was trying to examine and be more careful about and be a partner on? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Why do you think you named a couple of things, a pay disparity and the biological fact of nursing.
Yeah.
Is that it? Like, is there more going on that you think this is such a hetero male female generalization that women end up exhausted?
I do think women have a different standard than men. And I do think there's, I don't want to speak for everyone, but yeah. In my marriage, I feel like my husband really wants to do a great job and really wants to meet me, you know, 50-50. And when he gives it his all, we get to about 70-30.
And, at best.
Yeah. And I mean, there's things I don't do that he does. But I do think that there is some kind of gap in the way we're raising boys or that boys have been raised where they don't necessarily expect to step in and do 50 or 60 or 70% themselves.
I heard a theory, feel free to destroy this, years ago, I don't remember who, some man explaining that he thought that women had a biological imperative to care more about stuff because if they didn't get stuff right, the infant would die. So they were wired to care more than men.
I am really uncomfortable talking about biological imperatives,
I know. And I
won't do it.
Okay.
But I do think that let's flip it around and focus on not what women want or what women should do, but focus instead on the idea that taking care of our stuff and our houses and our cooking and the stuff we live in the midst of is good for us. It makes us more human, more humble, more connected to the rhythm of daily life. It's something we should all be doing. You know, that's not just a construct to try to get my husband to do the dishes more. I think it is something that I would want for my son. When women are doing all the domestic work, they miss out on the opportunity to make money or lie in bed and stare at the dust motes or whatever it is that they want to do. But men also are limited in being full humans that they could be if they're not completely participating.
So what did you do with being exhausted and confined?
Well, what happened to me was I became very antsy, very chafy about the captivity piece of it. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself yearning to do bad behaviors. So yearning to
define bad.
Yes. Well, like wanting to just drink a lot, having sort of inappropriate friendships with men. I got kissed a couple times, like things that don't happen to Finney Ridge moms, right? That's not in the rule book.
Uh-huh.
And those things started to happen to me, or I started to seek them out. And, you know, independence, having a life outside the marriage, an emotional life outside the marriage, because I was feeling so confined. And I wouldn't say it was a positive experience, but it did define some issues for me. You know, like I realized like, oh, I do feel really constrained by marriage. And I think that a lot of us do. And also that kind of yearning for something more, something different, really connected me to the girl I had been when I was growing up in Seattle in the 1980s.
Which was kind of wild.
Yeah, I was kind of a wild kid, and I was definitely a kid who liked to get in trouble a lot. And I had thought I'd sort of gotten over all that when I was being the good mom and the good worker and the good wife. And then that feeling, that troubled person, kind of came roaring back in my mid-40s, and there she was again. It was like, you know, me now and younger me were sort of saluting each other across the years, and it was sort of appalling, and yet it happened.
And you were reading diaries about that Claire, that little Claire,
mm-hmm.
and you were having some possibly bad behavior, depending on what's bad.
Good point.
And what did that lead to?
you know, nothing. And I think that for me as a writer, that's what I'm interested in talking about. You know, a lot of memoir like Wild or Eat, Pray, Love is about escaping and going off and finding something different, following a dream or trying to find yourself. But most of us don't do that. We stay. And that's always what I'm interested in writing about. What about the people who stay? You have this sort of wild blossoming of yearning in your mid-40s. Well, okay, sure, go walk the Appalachian Trail or whatever it is, or have an affair and run off to Thailand or whatever. Most of us stay. And that's what I try to talk about in the book, both my experience now, but also my reckoning, as I say in my title, with the girl I was. You know, looking back on her was really painful at first. I went and I found all my diaries and my letters and my photos, and I would just, oh my God. I mean, imagine looking at your teenage diaries. It's horrific.
Yours sound more interesting.
Like,
than mine.
They're very badly written. But I think that I loathed her so much. I had so much self-loathing about that kid I had been. And a lot of the book deals with me learning to see her more clearly and approach her with more compassion. So I'm really thinking a lot about how we don't change. You know, memoirs are almost always these books about transformation.
Yeah.
I got better. And this book says, what if we don't really change? What if we just come to terms with who we are?
Yeah. How do you get through a midlife crisis that's brought on by following all the rules and staying, and then you still stay? So what did you do with all of that? You know, wanderlust and everything.
There's a lot of small rebellions, you know, leaving town with friends, or intellectual rebellions, you know, like working on writing this book and working on thinking about these things. But I didn't do anything with it. I'm still married. I'm still, you know, taking care of my kids. I think I endured it.
And then it passed?
Well, I don't know. I feel a little better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, not the most enthralling ending.
How does your husband feel about all this? By the way, he's not that anonymous a guy.
No.
He's a writer. I know him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
What is your marriage now that it wasn't? Is it the same thing it always was?
Well, when I was going through all this, I started thinking about, isn't there some different way to be married? You know, is there some other way to be married? Somewhere between feeling completely trapped and this kind of idea that we're going to have an open marriage and be polyamorous, and, you know, which I guess is an up and coming thing with the millennials. I don't know. I've been hearing about this. So what's in between?
Yeah.
And I realized as kind of the years went on that we were sort of inventing it without even realizing it. You know, he travels all the time for work. He's an environmental journalist. And then I began to travel a lot more for work. So we supported each other in these sort of forays into the world and accepted it, that that was going to be part of our lives. Or if I want to go look at 12 art shows in LA with my best friend over the weekend, that's a priority that's important, right? So we just built it in this sort of in-between way.
And it's really 50-50 okay? Because usually one person is more into a marital change than the other person.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think that it already existed. I think I was the domestic person and my husband traveled for work all the time, as an adventure journalist does. And so I think that when I wanted to start exploring the boundaries of our marriage a little bit more, I mean, could he say no?
He stayed.
Yeah, he stayed. Lucky me.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that. Is this just your story, Claire, or is there something you wish for your readers and right now your listeners?
I feel like this is a story about coming to terms with, this is going to sound super pretentious, but it is a story about coming to terms with one's own mortality. Hmm. You know, I think you come into your mid-40s and you start to realize, like, you know, is this really my whole life? And I feel like that story has been told over and over and over by men. When women write this, first of all, it happens very rarely. And second of all, it always gets called menopause. It becomes a biological story. And for me, this idea that there could be midlife despair that is basically a universal human experience of like, oh, crap, I'm coming to the end. I felt like it was really important to talk about that from a female point of view and to let women who are going through that know it's happening to other women. you know, the book is written as like a, you know, I wanted to take it as a football and throw it back at my younger self from when I was like 45, when I was really feeling sad. Just to say, there's a lot of people experiencing this. Because as I started to talk to other women and describe what I was experiencing, they would just look at me with these like loony, vacant, hungry eyes, like, yes, me too. So I'm trying to connect with them and say, we're having a universal experience and we'll get through it.
Claire Dieterer, the new book is Love and Trouble, just out. And it's just so great to talk with you about this. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Claire Dieterer talking with Bill Radke. She's at Town Hall Seattle tomorrow night at 7:30. Thanks for listening to The Record today. Bill Radke will be back tomorrow to talk about the Seattle mayor's race, President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey, and more with his guests on Week in Review. This has been The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel.